Hi everyone, it's Doug Mayhew and I'm here with Jared Rosoff, Director of Product Marketing at TenGen. And as you guys may know, TenGen is kind of the big mover and shaker in the MongoDB world, and we're doing a lot with Mongo these days. Mongo's running on Azure thanks to some work you guys have helped us do there. And thought today we'd just talk about NoSQL, which is pretty new to all of us coming from the Microsoft.NET tradition, and how you guys at TenGen look at that and look at Mongo. I know some of the things that you guys have helped us enable, as of last December, now we have Mongo replica sets running on Azure.
That's right. There's the worker role projects. So some of our engineers are working with some Microsoft engineers and have a system that I can just deploy a replica set to Azure. And it's completely managed inside the PaaS, so it'll restart nodes if they fail, and gives me that Mongo capability out of the box right inside Azure.
Cool, and that's very consistent with how we're looking at Azure as a platform where you can quickly scale out and make things really reliable by having lots of instances of the same sorts of processes running. And maybe as a good place to start, since the replica set failover sort of model that Mongo has is new to a lot of us, maybe you could help us understand that. And also, I know you guys do sharding is another thing that's kind of a big part of the Mongo value proposition. Kind of just help us understand those basic concepts.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me go to the whiteboard and we'll see it.
Go
have some pictures and make it clear. So with MongoDB, when you deploy Mongo, we're all used to like running a database server, right? Now in Mongo, we deploy the database server as a replica set. So what that means is I have a primary node in my replica set, and then I can have multiple secondary nodes. And I might have 10 of these, I might have 3 of them, but this is a kind of traditional master-slave type database. So the objects of the primary are writable. Anybody can write to these. The objects and the slaves are read-only. So this gives me read scaling, because I can send my read traffic to additional secondaries, and I can keep adding more secondaries if I want to get more read capacity out of the database. Now, the other thing that the replica set does is it gives me high availability. Right? So if the primary dies, we're automatically going to promote one of our secondaries to a new primary, and that'll take over. And that's completely transparent to your application.
And when you say automatically, how does this magic happen? Who decides who gets to be primary?
That's a good question. Well, there's a protocol that goes on between all these nodes. So they all monitor each other. Let's see if I can connect all of them. What happens is there's an election protocol. So if a node dies, the remaining members go through rounds of voting. Right? And they try to decide who's going to become the new master. And that takes into account a number of factors. So one of the factors is consensus. Right? So we have some number of copies of data, some number of replicas. In this example here, there's 4 copies. Right? So consensus means that I have to have more than 50% of the cluster agreeing upon who the new leader is. Right? So what that means, if I have 4 nodes and I go down to 3, that means that as long as there's 3 nodes, I'll agree on a master, because 3 is more than half the cluster. If I go down to 2 nodes, now I only have half the cluster. I can't agree on consensus, so you'll go read-only. Now, the reason we want to do that is because of the split-brain problem. Right? So imagine there was a network partition that cut my replica set in half. Right? Mm-hmm. What might happen, what would be bad, is if I had a primary on this half of the partition and then another primary on this half of the partition. Right? If that happened, now I'd have 2 writable copies of the object, and I might have inconsistency.
So you're describing a scenario where once that's cut in half, this primary thinks he just lost 2 of his minions, so he just keeps merrily moving along with 1 secondary, the other side promotes 1, and now at some point in the future when they're back together, there's chaos.
That's going to be a chaos, because imagine I'm keeping track of your bank balance, and I'm making withdrawals over here, and I'm making withdrawals over here. I don't even know what your balance is, because they don't agree with each other. So we want to make sure that we can always have a majority of the cluster to elect a primary. And so the replica set gives us that. It gives us read scaling, because I can add more servers, and that gives me more read capacity. It also gives me high availability, because the secondaries can elect a new primary should the existing one die.
Now, you say more than 50%. Suppose you have 4 that are voting, and 2 vote for you and 2 vote for me. Who wins?
Well, nobody, right? So that's 50%. That means everybody's going to go read-only. So you tend to want to have an odd number of nodes in your cluster so that if there's any single point of failure, you still have a majority left.
Got it.
Now, the replica set, this gives us read scaling. But because there's only a single primary, It means that I'm limited in how much write traffic I can send to the database. So we overcome that with sharding. So go back to our simplifier diagram. So here I have a replica set, the primary and two secondaries. Mm-hmm. What I can do is I can deploy more of these. And so now, each one of these things we call a shard. Each one is a replica set. And the way Mongo works is it's actually going to partition my data automatically across these shards. Right, so for example, let's say I'm storing users. And I might use email address as my shard key. So what Mongo's going to do is it's going to partition my users across the shards based on partitioning of the email address keys. So for example, all the email addresses, you know, A through F might live in this shard, G through R over here, S through Z over here. Now this is actually simplistic. We break these up into much smaller chunks, so they're all still contiguous ranges, but this might be broken up into thousands of smaller ranges and distributed across the cluster.
And as part of the configuration, you have control of deciding what the shard key is and how to
break this up. Yeah, so the objects that we're storing inside this database are JSON objects. Right? So just like you're used to using your in JavaScript, you know, it's like I can construct key value pairs, so I might have a document that looks like this. Email, JSR, at 10gen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But what's interesting is that inside our database, we can do things like we can store arrays. Right? So I might have, my instant messenger accounts. Right? And I might have an array of them. So I'm, for Jared. I also have one called Jared at 10gen. So I can store arrays inside of this thing. I can also store structured data. So, you know, my address might be a nested object that has a street, a city, a state. Right? So we can store these complex objects inside of the database natively. You know, in a relational database, I would need to use a join and store these in a different table. I might store these in a separate table because they're not necessarily part of the master record. They're details that augment it. But in Mongo, I can store all of this stuff inside my object. and then when I'm partitioning, I'm going to choose one of these keys. In this case, we said the email address. But maybe I want to partition on my instant messenger address, or maybe address.state, so I partition users by what state they live in.
Now, what about, Mongo's schemaless, so I don't have to have any of those columns or properties with a particular document in a collection. So what about one that doesn't have an email address, let's say, and I define that as a sharding key? What happens then?
Well, you have to have, when you use a shard key, you have to have that key in every document.
So you've kind of created a requirement then
for
that particular key.
Exactly. Okay. Now, if you're not running with sharding, if you're just running a replica set, then what you said is true. I don't need to have an email address. Every document can have whatever fields it wants. But once I turn on sharding, anytime I insert a document, I have to have a value for the shard key inside that document.
Got it. And then you described replica sets as kind of helping with read throughput.
Mm-hmm.
And here, now we've got a solution to write throughput on a large scale. What about thinking the combination of the two? Let's say that one of those shards, that replica set, drops down to where there's only one or two left, and now it's read-only. Am I seeing that clearly?
Well,
what happens is
within the shard, failover works just like we described before. So let's say this server dies.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I might elect a new master from the remaining members of the shard. Now, if I lose an entire shard, basically, what's going to happen then is that range of data is going to be inaccessible.
And could you have a scenario where one range is read-only and the others are all read-write?
Yes. So, for example, if let's say in this copy two servers failed and I only had one remaining node, that node would be read-only. But you know that's only impacting that part of the cluster where that failure occurred. This shard is still fully read-write capable. Now, you want to avoid this type of situation, right? So the way we commonly do this is you want to make sure, you know, typically if this is happening, that here you've got a multiple failure scenario. So this might happen if you do something like, say, I have one physical server, and I put three virtual machines on top of it, and then I run my primary, secondary as three virtual machines, right? That's not a very good idea, because I really have, you know, I'm making a single point of failure into a multiple point of failure.
Yeah.
So what we tend to do is we tend to group these things, and we say, you know, you want to organize so that these are in different failure groups, right? So ideally, I might put these in, for example, in like an East Coast data center, and these in a West Coast data center, right? So that way, you know, if I, you know, one of the cases where I might lose a whole bunch of servers is if a data center goes down, right? So in that case, let's say East Coast went down, that would just wipe out these nodes. Now, a cross shard, that's no big deal. Each shard still has enough nodes to elect the primary, so it's still going to have to be fully read-write capable. But you want to try to avoid situations where you're going to have these horizontal failures of everybody in a node failing, everybody in a shard failing.
Now these concepts, replica sets and sharding, we hear about NoSQL, which is always struck me as an odd term because it's not a thing, it's a not thing. Mm-hmm. It's everything that's not SQL or something like that. I'm curious, replica sets and sharding, as you've described here, is this kind of Mongo's special area? Does this apply more broadly to other NoSQL technologies, or how would you...
So the NoSQL market in general was kind of born out of a need to scale horizontally. As soon as you start running in cloud environments where I can only get a machine with so many gigabytes of RAM, I can't go to any of our clouds and say buy a 100 CPU machine with a terabyte of RAM and a storage area network behind it. I might be able to get that in my data center, but I can't get that in a cloud. And so in order to run high-scale systems in that kind of environment, we need something that's horizontally scalable. Now, the problem with relational databases has been that the relational algebra is very difficult to make work across a distributed set of nodes. The reason for that is really two things. First of all, is joins. So if we imagine that this cluster of nodes was a relational database, the problem is that the data I might be trying to join, let's say the main row might live here, and I'm trying to join my instant messenger list, they might live across these two nodes, and my address might live over here. So now when I need to send a query to the cluster, I end up talking to five different servers, right? So joins, that's sort of a simple example. There are a lot of cases where you would actually need to talk to every node in the cluster, essentially cable scan in your cluster in order to do this. So the problem is joins are really difficult to work in a horizontally scaled environment like this. The other problem is transactions. If I want to do multi-statement transactions, where I open a transaction, read some records, write some records, perform some computation, then commit the transaction, the problem is I end up needing to coordinate transactions in sort of a two-phase commit style or some transaction commit protocol across a large number of servers. That's very difficult to scale. Right. So as a result of this, what we find is a lot of the relational data stores have a lot of trouble giving you the full feature set of the relational algebra of SQL across a horizontally scaled cluster.
So in general, there's scenarios or architectural problems that lend themselves well to the relational world, and others that lend themselves well to the NoSQL.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, the relational model is brilliant. SQL is a fantastic tool. There's nothing wrong with it, right? Not at all. But there's a lot of problem domains where, you're not using joins, you're just, accessing individual objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those cases, what we really want is a data store that's going to be able to scale up horizontally. And if I leave out those features, it's much easier to build that database and to make it scale and to make it go fast. Right?
Got it.
Now, the problem is if I take out joins and transactions from SQL, SQL is kind of tough to use, right? If I can only access individual rows at a time. So that's where the data model comes in. That's why having things like arrays and nested objects is so important. Because when I have these things, this overcomes a lot of the places where I might need to use a join or I might need a transaction, right? In those cases, I can store this as a single document, and I'm still doing individual operations on objects, just putting and getting and querying individual documents, but I don't need to join this data together. It's all co-located on disk. It lives on one server, so it's very fast and very scalable.
Yeah, you have like one collection as a whole normalized multi-table relational model, the relational world.
Yeah.
So these sorts of concepts, one thing I'm curious about that perhaps we should have talked about earlier, Mongo is this open source technology for NoSQL, And then 10Gen is kind of the company center. Can you kind of describe how 10Gen and Mongo come together? What do you guys do in the Mongo world?
Yeah, absolutely. So 10Gen actually built MongoDB. All of the kernel committers of MongoDB are 10Gen employees. And we've released the code open source. It was licensed under the AGPL license. And at 10Gen, we provide support for the database. So you can sign a support contract with us. We'll be on call for your developers, your operations team, if any issues come up or if you have questions about how to use it. And we do training and consulting to help people become better MongoDB users.
Cool. Well, Jared, this has been a great overview of kind of the basics of NoSQL. I know, as I said early on, a lot of us from the Microsoft world are new to this, from the .NET stack and those people. And I think there's a lot of interesting implications of these concepts that we're all still working through. It's great to have you guys involved here. I look forward to talking about this more.
Great. Thanks a lot.